Welcome back to Roshcast Episode 2.
We hope you all enjoyed Episode 1, and remember to send us any and all feedback to roshcast@roshreview.com. We are both new to the podcast world and are relying on all of your feedback to make each episode as high yield as possible.
Just like your typical ED shift, in this episode, we're going to throw questions at you from all angles, from surgery to psychiatry and pregnancy to VTech.
So let's get started with some pharmacology. Nitrate therapy works by which of the following mechanisms? Is it A, reducing afterload? B, reducing both preload and afterload? C, reducing cardiac contractility? Or D, reducing preload?
Well, I know nitrates definitely reduce preload. I'm not sure about afterload. I'm going to guess choice D, nitrates reduce preload.
Well, you're actually pretty close, but the answer here is choice B. Nitrates reduce both preload and afterload. Nitrates are frequently used in the emergency department, so let's review their mechanism and some of the side effects. Nitrate therapy works by reducing both the preload and the afterload by dilating veins, coronary arteries, and systemic arteries by relaxing vascular smooth muscles. This can have a huge effect on the patient by increasing venous capacitance and improving coronary blood flow by coronary vasodilatation. Additionally, the decreased preload lowers the left ventricular end diastolic pressure, thereby decreasing the ventricular wall stress. This results in a decrease in the myocardial oxygen demand, but don't forget that such vasodilatation can cause rebound tachycardia as well.
Great review. Remind me, are there any patient populations that shouldn't be treated with nitrates?
That's a really good question. Obviously, your clinical gestalt should guide you, and there are no hard and fast rules. But in general, nitrates should be avoided in patients with a systemic blood pressure less than 90, a heart rate less than 50 or greater than 100, those with suspected right ventricular infarct, or those who have taken phosphodiesterase inhibitors for erectile dysfunction within the last 24 hours, and finally, those with HOCM or severe AS.
Great point about the right ventricular infarct. That's a very typical exam question. For an EKG with ST elevation in the inferior leads, always avoid nitrates. Keeping with the vascular theme, here's a question about a potentially catastrophic vascular emergency. What is the most common exam finding reported in patients with acute aortic dissection? Is it A, aortic insufficiency, B, hypertension, C, hypotension, or D, pulse deficit?
Well, it's definitely not hypotension and pulse deficit, so I'm left with aortic insufficiency and hypertension. I think I'm going to go with choice A, aortic insufficiency.
The answer here is actually choice B, hypertension. The most common exam finding in those with acute aortic dissection is hypertension, which is seen in about 49% of patients. Hypertension is also the most common risk factor, which is seen in about 70% of patients with aortic dissection. Do you know the major risk factors for aortic dissection?
Well, there are two very common risk factors for aortic dissection. That would be hypertension and age. There are also some more rare but important to remember risk factors, such as connective tissue disorders, a bicuspid aortic valve, giant cell arteritis, annuloaortic ectasia, family history, cocaine use, and of course, iatrogenic causes.
Interesting. And what's the difference between a type A aortic dissection and a type B aortic dissection?
Type A dissections are in the ascending aorta. It's easy to remember, by A for ascending. And type B dissections are found in the descending aorta. Remember B for below. Type A dissections are typically managed surgically, and type B dissections are managed medically.
And since we just discussed nitrates as a blood pressure lowering agent, should you use them in patients with an acute aortic dissection?
Nitrates aren't the ideal medication. Instead, IV esmolol run via a continuous IV infusion is actually the medication of choice. Esmolol both lowers the blood pressure and, very importantly, decreases the shearing force against the dissected aorta. While nitrates may lower the blood pressure, they do not decrease the shearing force, which is critical in such cases.
We just covered a lot, so let me recap. The most common finding in aortic dissection is hypertension. In addition to analgesics to control the pain, IV esmolol is the first-line medication to lower the blood pressure and decrease the shearing forces. Type A dissections involve the ascending aorta, and type B involve the descending aorta. Remember B for below.
The next one is going to be a question about a rare but incredibly dangerous pregnancy emergency. A 32-year-old woman at 20 weeks gestation presents to the emergency department after having had a seizure. Her vital signs are significant only for a slight tachycardia to 105, but are otherwise normal. She is confused without focal deficits. A stat CBC reveals a hemoglobin of 7 and platelets of 12,000. Later, you get a call from the lab that they see schistocytes on the peripheral smear. Which of the following is the most appropriate treatment for her condition? Is it A, delivery of the fetus, B, magnesium sulfate, C, plasmapheresis, or D, platelet transfusion?
Tough two-part question here. First, we must diagnose the problem. The patient is confused, anemic, and thrombocytopenic, which are all characteristics of thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP. To treat TTP, we must perform plasmapheresis, which is choice C.
Well done. This patient has four of the five parts of the classic pentad of TTP: CNS abnormalities, renal pathology, fever, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, and thrombocytopenia. And don't forget that TTP shares many of the same characteristics of HELLP syndrome, but HELLP syndrome typically occurs after 24 weeks gestation. Our patient here is only 20 weeks pregnant, so TTP is more likely. Plasmapheresis can achieve remission in up to 80% of patients with TTP.
Since plasmapheresis typically takes a while to set up in the ER, is there an alternative temporizing measure we can perform?
Absolutely. If plasmapheresis cannot be immediately performed, FFP, or fresh frozen plasma, should be administered until the plasmapheresis can be performed.
All right, while we're waiting for the FFP to be sent up, a 72-year-old man presents with acute onset palpitations. A stat EKG shows a wide complex tachycardia at a rate of 140. Which of the following EKG findings supports a diagnosis of ventricular tachycardia? Is it A, discordance of the QRS axis in the precordial leads, B, fusion beats, C, leftward axis, or D, ST elevation greater than 5 millimeters?
Well, I know that a rightward superior axis deviation is more characteristic of ventricular tachycardia, so it's not choice C. ST elevation is not characteristic for ventricular tachycardia, so it's not choice D. The answer here must be answer choice B. Fusion beats support a diagnosis of ventricular tachycardia.
That's right. Great process of elimination. Can you remind me what a fusion beat is?
Sure. A fusion beat occurs when impulses from two different locations activate the ventricle. One impulse is typically ventricular and the other is typically supraventricular. This results in a QRS complex with a hybrid morphology, that of a sinus beat and an intraventricular beat.
Hold on a second, then what is a capture beat and how are they different?
These are pretty similar, so pay close attention. A capture beat occurs when a sinus beat is conducted with a normal sinus QRS morphology within a wide complex tachycardia. So you basically will have an EKG with several ventricular beats in a row with a normal QRS beat within the run of VTAC. This is in contrast to a fusion beat, which is the combined electrical signal from the two beats originating from two different locations at one time.
Thanks for clarifying that. And what are the treatment options for ventricular tachycardia?
It's easiest to remember if you break it down into three different categories. The first category is pulseless ventricular tachycardia, which is treated with immediate defibrillation. Hemodynamically unstable ventricular tachycardia is treated with synchronized cardioversion. Lastly, stable ventricular tachycardia is treated with procainamide, amiodarone, or synchronized cardioversion in refractory cases.
Thanks for that review, Jeff. Let's move on to a question about kids. A 3-year-old girl presents with vaginal spotting. She has absolutely no complaints and denies abuse or trauma. Mom is very worried that somebody may have abused her. On exam, the child is acting appropriately. Her external exam shows no signs of trauma. An internal pelvic isn't possible due to age. Which of the following statements is true? Is it A, obtain a pelvic x-ray prior to attempting a physical exam? B, she is a victim of abuse. Do no further evaluation without a trained nurse present and contacting the authorities. C, she may have a vaginal foreign body. Consider a nasal speculum to attempt visualization and removal. Or D, vaginitis is an unusual diagnosis in this age group.
Well, this is clearly a very sensitive topic. But given no signs of abuse, I'm going to go with choice C. She may have a foreign body. Consider a nasal speculum to attempt visualization and removal.
That's absolutely correct. And don't forget that procedural sedation may also be useful in such delicate exams. Let's quickly review why the other answer choices are wrong. An X-ray would only identify radio-opaque objects and is of limited diagnostic utility, and the radiation is harmful. Without any signs of trauma, physical and sexual abuse move lower in the differential.
I wouldn't think vaginitis is very common in a 3-year-old. Is that the case?
Actually, it is very common. Remember, 3-year-olds lack estrogen, are in the midst of developing toileting habits, and often take baths using perfumed soaps and bubbles, which can lead to irritation.
I guess those are great points, and it all makes sense. Let's move on to the next question. Continuing with the theme of pregnancy from earlier, let's move into the postpartum period. A nursing mother presents complaining of an inflamed and painful right breast. She is febrile to 38.3 and tachy to the low hundreds. On exam, she has extensive cellulitis of the right breast that begins at the nipple. You correctly start antibiotic therapy. Mom wants some recommendations about breastfeeding before she goes, though. What should you advise her to do? A, consult her obstetrician. B, continue to breastfeed, but only from the uninfected breast. C, continue to breastfeed from both breasts. Or D, wean from breastfeeding and begin formula feeding.
What you're describing here is acute mastitis. The correct answer choice would be choice C, continue to breastfeed from both breasts. Nursing dilates the mammary blood vessels and improves blood flow to the infected tissue. This may also help speed symptom resolution.
And since many antibiotics can potentially be passed to the infant via breast milk, this is not an antibiotic choice to be taken lightly. What antibiotic would you prescribe in this case?
Well, first-line therapy would be an oral antibiotic like dicloxacillin, which would cover the most common pathogens that are from the infant's skin, mouth, or nose.
And if there were an abscess and she were still breastfeeding, would the advice be the same?
Exactly the same. Nurse through the infection.
All right, before we close out this episode, why don't you load up one more last question?
Okay, let's do a toxicology question. The patient is a 34-year-old schizophrenic on lithium who's presenting with new onset tremors and confusion. His vitals are normal, but the physical is significant for confusion and hyperreflexia. Basic labs reveal sodium of 165 and a lithium level of 4.2. After starting IV hydration, what other treatments should be initiated? Is it A, activated charcoal, B, bicarbonate infusion, C, gastric lavage, or D, hemodialysis?
So this is clearly lithium toxicity, as a lithium level of 4.2 is way too high. But even if you were unsure about the cutoffs for overdose, this patient has many of the classic signs of toxicity: tremors, confusion, and hyperreflexia. Although waiting for the lithium level may confirm your suspicion, the history alone gives you enough information to start initiating therapy, which in this case would be choice D, hemodialysis.
Correct. And how do you explain the hypernatremia?
Well, the hypernatremia in this case is actually due to the development of diabetes insipidus.
And what symptoms or lithium levels require immediate dialysis?
So there's a couple that you need to remember. Hemodialysis is required in an acute ingestion with a lithium level of greater than 4, in a chronic ingestion with a lithium level of greater than 2.5, or any elevated level with neurologic symptoms, renal failure, or an inability to tolerate IV hydration.
And before we call it quits for today, what EKG changes are seen with lithium toxicity?
You can see bradycardia, T-wave flattening, and QTC prolongation.
Excellent. Let's end this episode with a rapid review. Nitrates reduce both preload and afterload by dilating vascular smooth muscles.
The most common finding in aortic dissection is hypertension.
TTP is treated with plasmapheresis. If that's not immediately available, you can use FFP as a temporizing measure.
Don't confuse fusion beats with capture beats, which are normal supraventricular beats within a run of wide complex beats.
Vaginitis is fairly common in young females. Always keep potential child abuse on the differential, even if the suspicion is low.
In febrile mastitis, dicloxacillin is an appropriate first-line agent to cover the normal flora from the infant's nose, mouth, or skin. Remember to keep nursing from the affected breast to help cure the infection.
Lithium toxicity with a lithium level greater than 4 in an acute ingestion or a level greater than 2.5 in chronic ingestion requires emergent dialysis. Emergent dialysis should also be initiated with any neurologic findings secondary to lithium toxicity.
All right, so that wraps up RoshCast episode 2. Stay tuned for more high-yield Rosh review in the next episode coming soon.